she's the one we thought her to be, Quick Ben said quietly. So far, so good.
In other words, the assassin growled, if I'd attacked her, I'd be a dead man right now.
Exactly. We'll take her out when the time's right, but for now we need her.
Kalam nodded.
Phoenix in?
Damn right. And when we get there, the first thing I'm doing is buying a drink.
Quick Ben smiled.
Agreed.
Ralik looked up as the heavy-set man entered the bar. His black skin marked him a southerner, which in itself was not unusual. What caught Ralik's attention, however, was the horn-handled silver-pommeled long knives tucked into the man's narrow belt. Those weapons were anything but southern, and stamped on the pommels was a cross-hatched pattern, recognizable to all within the trade as the mark of an assassin. The man swaggered into the room as if he owned it, and none of the locals he shouldered aside seemed inclined to disagree with him. He reached the bar and ordered an ale. Ralik studied the dregs in his own tankard. Obviously, the man wanted to be marked, precisely by someone like Ralik Nom, a guild assassin. So, who was the bait then? This didn't fit. Ocelot, his clan leader, was convinced, along with everyone else in the guild, that Empire Claws had come into the city, and now waged war against them. Ralik wasn't so sure. The man standing at the bar could as easily be Seven Cities as a traveler from Kalos. He had the look of Malazan Empire about him. Was he Claw? If so, why show himself? Up until now, the enemy hadn't left a single clue or a single eyewitness as to their identity. The brazenness he now observed either didn't fit or marked a reversal of tactics. Had Vorkan's order to go to ground triggered it? Alarm bells rang in Ralik's head. None of this felt right. Murillo leaned close to him.
Is something wrong, friend?
Guild business, Ralik replied.
You thirsty? Murillo grinned. An offer I can't refuse.
After a single bemused glance at Cole's unconscious form, slumped in the chair, the assassin left the table. What had all that been about five black dragons? He made his way to the bar. As he pushed through the crowd, he gave one youth a hard elbow to the back. The boy gasped, then surreptitiously slipped toward the kitchen. Ralik arrived, called Skurve over, then ordered another pitcher. Though he did not look the man's way, he knew he had been marked by him. It was no more than a feeling, but one he'd learned to trust. He sighed as Skurve delivered the foaming pitcher. Well, he'd done what Ocelot had demanded of him, though he suspected his clan leader would be asking for more. He returned to the table and conversed with Murillo for a time, plying his friend with the majority of the ale. Murillo sensed a growing tension around Ralik and took his cue. He drained the last of his drink and rose.
Well, he said, Crappus scurried off, Crocus too, and Cole's once again dead to the world. Ralik, I thank you for the ale. Time to find a warm bed. Until tomorrow, then.
Ralik remained seated for another 5 minutes, only once brushing gazes with the black man leaning against the bar. Then he rose and strode into the kitchen. The two cooks rolled their eyes at each other as he strode past. Ralik ignored them. He came to the door, which had been left ajar in hopes of a cooling draught. The alley beyond was wet, though the rain had passed. From a shadowed recess on the wall opposite the inn stepped a familiar figure. Ralik walked up to Ocelot.
It's done. Your man is the big black one nursing an ale. Two daggers, hatch-marked. He looks mean, and not one I'd like to tussle with. It's all yours, Ocelot.
The man's pocked face twisted.
He's still inside. Good. Head back in. Make sure you've been noticed. Damn sure, Nom.
Ralik crossed his arms.
I'm sure already, he drawled.
You ought to draw him out. Lead him into Tarlo's warehouse, into the loading grounds.
Ocelot sneered.
Vulcan's orders, Noel. And when you head out, do it by the front door. No mistakes, nothing subtle.
The man's an assassin, Ralik grated. If I'm not subtle, he'll know it's a trap and crawl all over me in seconds flat.
You do as Vulcan wills, Nom. Now get back inside.
Ralik stared at his commander to make his disgust plain, then returned to the kitchen. The cooks grinned at him, but only for a moment. One look at Ralik's face was enough to kill any humor in the room. They bent to their tasks, as if prodded by a landmaster. Ralik entered the main room, then stopped dead in his tracks.
Damn,
he muttered. The black man was gone. Now what? He shrugged.
Front door it is.
He made his way through the crowd. In an alley on one side of which ran a high stone wall, Crocus leaned against the damp bricks of a merchant's house and gazed steadily at a window. It was on the third floor, beyond the wall, and behind its shuttered face was a room he knew intimately. There'd been a light on inside for most of the 2 hours he'd stood below, but for the last 15 minutes, the room within had been dark. Numb with exhaustion and plagued with doubts, Crocus pulled his cloak tighter around him. He wondered what he was doing here, and not for the first time. All his resolve seemed to have drained into the gutters along with the rain. Had it been the dark-haired woman in the Phoenix Inn? Had she rattled him that much? The blood on her dagger made it obvious that she wouldn't hesitate to kill him just to keep her secret intact. Maybe it was the spinning coin that had him so confused. Nothing about that incident had been natural. What was so wrong with his dream of being introduced to the Dahl Maiden? It had nothing to do with that killer woman in the bar.
Nothing, he mumbled, then scowled.
Now he was talking aloud to himself. A thought came to him that deepened his scowl. Everything had begun its mad unraveling the night he had robbed the maiden. If only he hadn't paused, if only he hadn't looked upon her soft, round, lovely face. A groan escaped him, and he shifted his feet. A highborn. That was the real problem, wasn't it? It all seemed so stupid now, so absurd. How could he have convinced himself that such a thing as meeting her was possible? He shook himself. It didn't matter. He'd planned this. Now it was time to do it.
I don't believe this,
he muttered as he pushed himself from the wall and headed down the alley. His hand brushed the pouch tied to his waist.
I'm about to put a maiden's ransom back.
He came to the stone wall he'd been looking for and began to climb. He drew a deep breath.
All right, let's get it done,
he thought to himself. The stone was wet, but he had enough determination in him to scale a mountain. He climbed on and did not slip even so much as a single foothold. Chapter 13 There's a spider here in this corner, in that. Her three eyes tiptoe in darkness. Her eight legs track my spine. She mirrors and mocks my pacing. There's a spider here who knows all of me, her web my history full writ. Somewhere in this strange place, a spider waits for my panicked flight. The Conspiracy. Blind Galan, born 1078. As soon as the guild assassin left the room, Kalam drained the last of his beer, paid up, and ascended the staircase. From the gallery railing, he studied the crowd below. Then, seeing that no one paid him much attention, he strode down the hallway and entered the last room on the right. He closed the door and locked it. Quickben was seated cross-legged on the floor within a circle of melted blue wax. The wizard was hunched over, bare-chested, his eyes shut and droplets of sweat trickling down his face. Around him the air shimmered, as if glossed with lacquer. Kalam walked around the wax circle to the bed, He took a leather satchel from a peg above the bedpost and set it down on the thin, straw-filled mattress. Peeling back the flap, he removed the contents. A minute later, he'd laid out the mechanisms for a goat's foot arbalest. The crosspost metal parts had been blued, the narrow wooden stock soaked in pitch and dusted with black sand. Kalam slowly, quietly, assembled the weapon. Quick Ben spoke behind him.
Done. Whenever you're ready, friend.
The man left through the kitchen, but he'll be back, Kalam said, rising with the arbalest in his hands. He attached a strap to it and slung the weapon over one shoulder. Then he faced the wizard. I'm ready.
Quick Ben also stood, wiping his forehead with a sleeve.
Two spells. You'll be able to float, control every descent. The other should give you the ability to see anything magical. Well, almost anything. If there's a high mage kicking around, we're out of luck.
And you? Kalam asked as he examined his quiver of bolts.
You won't see me directly, just my aura,
Quick Ben replied with a grin.
But I'll be with you all the way.
Well, hopefully this'll go smoothly. We make contact with the guild, we offer the Empire's contract. They accept and remove for us every major threat in the city.
He shrugged into his black cloak and pulled up the hood.
You sure we can't just go downstairs and walk right up to the man? Lay it out?
Kalam shook his head.
Not how it's done. We've identified him. He's done the same with us. He's probably just made contact with his commander, and they'll arrange things to their liking. Our man should lead us now to the meet.
Won't it be an ambush we're walking into, then?
The large man agreed.
More or less, but they'll want to know what we want with them first. And once that's out, I doubt the guild's master will be interested in killing us. You ready?
Quick Ben raised a hand toward Kalam, then muttered briefly under his breath. Kalam felt a lightness come into him, rising to his skin and emanating a cushion of cool air that enveloped his body. And before his eyes, Quick Ben's figure formed a blue-green penumbra, concentrated at the wizard's long-fingered hands.
I have them, the assassin said, smiling. Two old friends.
Quick Ben sighed.
Yes, here we are doing this all over again.
He met his friend's gaze.
Hood's on our heels, Cal. I can feel his breath on my neck these days.
You're not alone in that.
Kalam turned to the window.
Sometimes, he said dryly, I have the feeling our empire wants us dead.
He walked to the window, unlatched the shutters, then swung them inward and leaned both hands on the sill. Quick Ben came up beside him and rested a hand on his shoulder. They gazed out at the darkness, a brief sharing of unease passing between them.
We've seen too much,
Quick Ben said softly.
Hood's breath, Kalam growled. What are we doing this for anyway?
Maybe if the Empire gets what it wants, the Rujistan, they'll let us slip away.
Sure, but who's going to convince the sergeant to walk out of the Empire?
We show him he hasn't got any choice.
Kalam climbed onto the sill.
Good thing I'm not a claw anymore. Just soldiers, right?
Behind him, Quick Ben touched his own chest and vanished. His disembodied voice held a note of wry amusement.
Right. No more cloak and dagger games for old Kalam.
The assassin pulled himself up, turning to face the wall, then beginning his climb to the roof.
Yeah, I've always hated it.
Quick Ben's voice was beside him now.
No more assassinations.
No more spying, Kalam added, reaching for the roof's edge.
No more disguising spells.
Clambering onto the roof, Kalam lay still.
No more daggers in the back,
he whispered, then sat up and scanned the nearby rooftops. He saw nothing, no unusual huddled shapes, no bright magical auras.
Thank the gods,
came Quick Ben's whisper from above.
Thank the gods,
Kalam echoed, then looked down over the roof's edge. Below, a pool of light marked the inn entrance.
You take the back door. I've got this one. Right.
Even as the wizard answered, Kalam stiffened.
There he is, he hissed. You still with me?
Quick Ben assented. They watched the figure of Ralik Nom, now cloaked, crossing to the far side of the street and entering an alley.
I'm on him,
Quick Ben said. A blue-green glow rose around the wizard. He rose into the air and flew out swiftly across the street, slowing as he reached the alley. Kalam climbed to his feet and padded silently along the roof's edge. Reaching the corner, he glanced down to the rooftop of an adjacent building, then jumped. He descended slowly, as if sinking through water, and landed without a sound. Off to his right, moving on a parallel path, was Quick Ben's magical aura. Kalam crossed the rooftop to the next building. Their man was heading for the harbor front. Kalam continued tracking Quick Ben's beacon, moving from one rooftop to the next, sometimes jumping down, at other times climbing. There was little subtlety about Kalam. Where others used finesse, he used the strength of his thick arms and legs. It made him an unlikely assassin, but he'd learned to use that to his advantage. They now approached the harbor area, the building single-storied and large, the streets rarely lit except around the double-door entrances to warehouses, where the occasional private guard lingered. In the night air hung the taint of sewage and fish. Finally, Quick Ben stopped, hovered over a warehouse courtyard, then hurried back to Kalam, who waited at the edge of a nearby two-storied clearinghouse.
Looks like the place,
Quick Ben said, floating a few feet above Kalam.
What now?
I want a good line of sight to that courtyard.
Follow me.
Quick Ben led him to another building. Their man was now visible, crouching on the warehouse roof, attention down on the courtyard below.
Cal, do you smell something bad about this?
Kalam snorted.
Hood, no. It's bloody roses out here. Take position, friend.
Right.
Ralik Nom lay down on the rooftop, his head out over its edge. Below was the warehouse's courtyard, flat, grey and empty. Directly beneath him, the shadows were impenetrable. Sweat trickled down Ralik's face. From the shadow below came Ocelot's voice.
He's got you inside?
Yes.
And he's not moving?
No. Listen. I'm sure there's more than one of them. I would have known if he'd been trailing me, and no one was. It stinks of Majory, Ocelot. And you know what I think about Majory.
Damn it, Nom. If you just start using the stuff we gave you, you'd rank among the best of us. But to Hood's Gate with that. We've got spotters. And unless there's a very good wizard around, we'd pick up on any magic. Face it.
A note of malice entered Ocelot's voice.
He's better than you. He tracked you all right, solo.
What now? Ralik asked.
Ocelot chuckled.
We're closing the circle, even as we speak. Your work's done, Nom. Tonight, the Assassin's War ends. In 5 minutes, you can head home.
High above the city, a demon flapped on leathery wings, its green reptilian eyes surveying the rooftops below with a vision that detected magic as easily as it did heat. Though the demon was no larger than a dog, its power was immense, near par to the man who had summoned and chained it this very night. On the rooftops, it saw two auras close together, one a man on whom spells had been cast, and the other a wizard, a very good wizard. In a ragged circle on either rooftops around these two, men and women moved inward, some betrayed by the heat of their bodies, others by items imbued with sorcery. Until now the demon rode the high night winds, bored and resentful of its master. A mere mission of observation, for one of such power. But now the demon felt a surge of bloodlust. If only its master had been weaker, so that it could break the bonds and descend to the rooftops, then there would have been slaughter. The demon was musing on these thoughts, its eyes fixed on the scene below, when a booted heel rammed into the back of its small, round head. The creature spun, tumbling, then twisted round to face its attacker, rage blazing in its skull. A moment later, it was fighting for its life. The figure that closed with the demon possessed a blinding magical aura. Grappling, the surging energies of both collided, enwrapped like tentacles. The demon struggled against the savage pain constricting it as the figure pressed its attack. A cold that burned filled the demon's skull. A cold, alien in its breath of power, so alien that the demon could find no means of countering it. The two fell slowly as they fought, dueling in absolute silence with forces invisible to the city's inhabitants below, while around them other figures descended toward the warehouse, cloaks spread like sails, crossbows crooked in their arms, hooded faces angled downward and hidden beneath black masks. There were 11 in all that passed the demon and its attacker. None of the others paid any attention, and with this realization, the demon experienced an emotion it had never known before. Fear. Its thoughts turned from battle to survival. The demon tore itself from its attacker's grasp. Loosing a high-pitched cry, it flapped upward. The figure did not pursue, instead joining the others in their silent descent to the city. As the 12 shrouded assassins dropped toward the circle of men and women below, one splitting off and angling above the circle's two targets, they took careful aim with their crossbows and began a massacre. Kalam stared down at the assassin lying supine on the roof below, wondering what to do next. Were they waiting for him to initiate contact? A low growl escaped him. Something was wrong. He could feel it like fever in his bones.
"Damn it, Quick! Let's get out of here!"
"Wait," came Quick Ben's disembodied voice. "Oh, damn," he said softly then. In front of Kalam, two brightly glowing shapes dropped down onto the roof below, landing behind their mark.
"What in Hood's name?"
Then he felt a slight tremor on the flat tiles beneath his hands. Kalam rolled onto his back, hearing a quarrel whiz past. Framed by his knees, a cloaked figure stood about 30 feet away. After missing with the quarrel, the figure raced forward. Another landed behind the first, near the roof's far edge. Kalam scampered. He dropped down over the roof's edge. Quick Ben floated above him. The spell of deflection he had raised about himself was a high-order magery, and he was certain he remained unseen by these new assailants. He watched as the approaching figure slowed, then padded cautiously to the roof edge, where Kalam had dropped from sight. Daggers gleaming in both gloved hands, the new assassin reached the edge and crouched. Quick Ben held his breath as the figure leaned forward. Kalam hadn't gone far. He gripped the roof's gables. When the attacker's upper body came into view, blotting out the stars behind it, he surged upward on the strength of one arm, his other shooting up to close on the assassin's neck with a vice-like grip. Kalam jerked the assassin downward, at the same time bringing up his knee. The attacker's cloth-wrapped face met his knee with a crunch. Kalam, still gripping the gable with one hand, gave the now limp figure a shake, then sent the body spiraling down to the street below. Gasping, he pulled himself back onto the roof. At the far end, he saw the second assassin whirl around. Growling, Kalam surged to his feet and sprinted at the figure. The unknown assassin stepped back as if startled, then brought a hand down and promptly vanished.
Kalam slid to a stop and stood crouched, both hands hanging at his sides.
I see her,
Quick Ben whispered. With a hiss, Kalam spun in a full circle, then danced to one side, putting his back to the roof's edge.
I don't. She's putting energy into it,
Quick Ben said.
I keep losing her. Wait, Cal.
The wizard fell silent. Kalam's head snapped with every muted sound. His breath gusted in and out from his nostrils. His hands twitched. Wait. A low rumble came from his chest. Wait for what? A knife in his throat? All at once, the night exploded with sound and fire. The attacker burst into view immediately in front of Kalam, dagger flashing at his chest. Smoke and sparks rained from her, but she moved as if unaffected. Kalam twisted to one side, trying to avoid the blade. The dagger tore through his shirt below his ribs, sinking deep into his flesh, then ripping sideways. He felt a hot gush of blood as he drove a fist into the woman's solar plexus. She gasped, reeling back, threads of blood whipping from the dagger in her right hand. Kalam charged forward with a snarl. He closed, and ignoring the assassin's dagger, punched into her chest again. Ribs cracked. His other hand flat-palmed her forehead. The assassin sprawled backward, landing with a thump on the roof. Her body stilled. Kalam sank to one knee, drawing in gulps of air.
Wait, you said. Damn it! What the hell's wrong with you, Quick?
He pushed a knot of cloth into the wound below his ribcage.
Quick!
There was no reply. He tensed, then turned and scanned the lower rooftops. Bodies lay scattered here and there. The warehouse roof, where he'd seen two figures land behind their mark, was empty. Groaning softly, he sank down onto his knees. With the woman's attack, he'd heard something amid the flashing fires. A boom. No, two booms, very close together. An exchange of magic. His breath caught. Was there a third assassin? A wizard? Quick Ben had damaged this one, but someone else had damaged Quick Ben.
Oh, Hood, he whispered, glaring about.
Ralik's first intimation of trouble was a sharp blow between his shoulder blades. The breath burst from his lungs, carrying with it the ability to move. His back throbbed, and he knew he'd been hit by a quarrel, but the Jazzarain armor under his shirt had withstood the impact. The quarrel's spiked head had pierced the iron, but had been too spent to push farther. Through the thumping pulse in his ears, he caught a pair of footsteps approaching him from behind. From the shadows below came Ocelot's voice.
Nom! What's happening?
Behind Ralik, the footsteps stopped, and there came the soft clacking of a crossbow being cocked. Ralik's wind returned, the numbness receding from his body. His own weapon lay beside him, ready. He waited.
Nom!
A soft footfall sounded behind him, and to the left. In one motion, Ralik rolled onto his back, grasped his crossbow, sat up, and fired. The assassin, less than 15 feet away, was thrown back by the quarrel's impact, its weapon flying. Ralik heaved himself to one side, only now seeing the second attacker well behind the first. The figure crouched and fired its crossbow. The quarrel caught Ralik's upper chest on the right, then ricocheted up past his head to disappear into the darkness. The blow left his right arm numb. He struggled to his feet, unsheathing his knife, the hooked blade a blue flicker in the night. The assassin opposite him took a careful step forward, then backed away to the far edge and dropped over the side.
Hood's breath,
came Ocelot's voice beside Ralik. He turned but saw no one.
He saw my magic, Ocelot said. Good work on the first one, Nom. Maybe we can finally determine who these people are.
I don't think so,
Ralik said, his eyes on the motionless body. An incandescent shimmer now wreathed it. As the body disappeared, Ocelot cursed.
Some kind of recall spell, he said.
Suddenly the clanmaster appeared in front of Ralik. His face twisted into a snarl as he glared about.
We set the trap. We end up dead.
Ralik did not reply. He reached over his shoulder, pulled out the quarrel, and tossed it to one side. The trappers had become the trapped, that was true, but he felt certain that the man who'd followed him had nothing to do with these newcomers. He turned and gazed up at the roof where his follower had been stationed. Even as he watched, there was a flash of red and yellow light and a double thunderclap, and in that instant, Ralik saw a silhouetted figure at the roof's edge, defending itself from a frontal attack. The flash winked out, leaving only darkness.
Majory,
Ocelot whispered.
High-power stuff, too. Come on, we're getting out of here.
They left quickly, climbing down into the warehouse court. Once she had marked them, Sari could find the fat little man and the coin-bearer effortlessly. Though she'd intended to trail this crupper after leaving Kalam and Quickben in the hut, something had drawn her instead to the boy. A suspicion, a sense that his actions were, at least for now, more important than Crupper's meanderings. The coin-bearer was the last of Opon's influence, and the god's most vital player in the game. Thus far, she had done well in eliminating the other potential players. Men like Captain Parron, who had been the adjunct's aide, and by extension, a servant to the Empress. And there had been that claw leader in Pale, the one she had garrotted. On her path to the Bridgeburners, others had been removed as well, but only as necessary. She knew that the boy would have to die, yet something within her seemed to be fighting that conclusion, and it was a part of her she could not recognize. She'd been taken, born a killer 2 years ago on a coastal road. The body she dwelt within was convenient, suitably unmarred by the events of a dramatic life. A young girl's body, a young girl whose mind was no match for the power that overwhelmed it, obliterated it. But was it obliterated? What had the coin touched inside her? And whose voice was this that spoke with such power and determination in her head? It had come upon her before, when Whiskey Jack had uttered the word, seer. She tried hard to remember any dealings she might have had with a seer in the last 2 years, but none came to mind. She pulled her cloak tighter about her shoulders. Finding the boy had been easy, but as to what he was up to, that was another matter. On the surface it looked no more complicated than a simple theft. Crocus had stood in an alley studying a lighted window on the third floor of an estate, waiting until the light went out. Wrapped in unnatural shadows as she was, he had not seen her as he scaled the slick wall she leaned against. He climbed with impressive grace and skill. After he had gone, she found another vantage point, which allowed her full view of the room's balcony and sliding doors. This had meant entering the estate's garden, but there had been only one guard patrolling the grounds. She'd killed him effortlessly, and now stood beneath a tree with her eyes on the balcony. Crocus had already reached it, had picked the lock, and entered the room beyond. He was quite good, she had to admit. But what thief would then spend close to half an hour in the chamber he was robbing? Half an hour, and still counting. She'd heard no alarms, seen no lights spring to life behind any of the estate's other windows. Nothing to indicate that anything had gone wrong. So what was Crocus doing in there? Sari stiffened. Sorcery had burgeoned in another part of Darujistan, and its flavor was known to her. She hesitated, unable to decide. Leave the lad and investigate this new, deadly emanation? Or remain here until Crocus re-emerged or was discovered? Then she saw something behind the balcony sliding doors that ended her indecision. Sweat ran down Crocus's face, and he found he had repeatedly to wipe it from his eyes. He had beaten the new triggers to get inside, the one on the balcony, the tripwire at the latch, and now padded to the makeup table. Once there, he froze, unable to move.
Idiot! What am I doing here? He thought to himself.
He listened to her soft, regular breathing behind him.
Like the breath of a dragon.
He was certain he could feel it gusting against the back of his neck. Crocus looked up and scowled at his own reflection in the mirror.
What was happening to him? If he didn't leave soon...
He began to remove his bag's contents. When he'd finished, he glanced again at his own face, to see another behind it, a round, white face, watching him from the bed. The girl spoke.
Since you're putting it all back, I'd prefer the proper arrangement. My makeup jar goes to the left of the mirror, she said in a whisper. The hairbrush goes to the right. Have you my earrings as well? Just leave them on the dresser.
Crocus groaned. He'd even forgotten to cover his face.
Don't try anything, he growled. I've returned everything, and now I'll leave. Understand?
The girl pulled her blankets about her and moved to the bed's end.
Threats won't work, thief, she said. All I need do is scream, and my father's master guardsman will be here in seconds. Would you cross your dagger with his short sword? No, said Crocus. I'd put it to your throat instead. With you as a hostage, with you between me and the guard, will he swing his blade at me? Unlikely.
The girl paled.
As a thief, you'd lose a hand. But kidnapping a highborn, it'd be the high gallows for you.
Crocus tried to shrug casually. He glanced at the balcony, gauging how fast he could be outside and then up on the roof. That new tripwire was a nuisance.
Stay where you are, the girl commanded. I'm lighting a lantern.
Why? Crocus demanded, fidgeting.
To see you better,
she replied, and light bloomed in the room from the lantern in her lap. He scowled. He hadn't noticed it there, so close at hand. She was ruining his plans, even as he made them.
What's the point in seeing me better? He snarled. Just call your damn guards and have me arrested. Be done with it.
He pulled the silk turban from his shirt and dropped it on the tabletop.
That's all of it, he said.
The girl glanced at the turban and shrugged easily.
That was to be part of my costume for the fete, she said. I've since found a nicer one. What, he hissed, do you want with me?
Fear showed momentarily on her face at his desperate outburst. Then she smiled.
I wish to know why a thief who succeeded in stealing all my jewels should now be returning them. That isn't something thieves usually do.
With good reason, he muttered, more to himself than to her. He stepped forward then stopped as she jerked back onto her bed, her eyes widening. Crocus raised a hand.
Sorry, didn't mean to frighten you. Only, I want to see you better, that's all. Why?
He was at a loss for an answer to that. After all, he couldn't very well tell her he'd fallen madly in love with her.
What's your name?
He blurted.
Shalice Dahl. What's yours?
Shalice.
Of course, he said, rolling his eyes. You would be named something like that.
He glared at her.
My name? None of your business. Thieves don't introduce themselves to their victims.
Her eyebrows rose.
Victim? But I'm no longer a victim, am I? You've settled that by returning. I'd think, she said slyly, you're more or less obliged to tell me your name, considering what you're doing. And you must be the type who treats obligations seriously. No matter how strange they seem.
Crocus frowned at that.
What was she talking about? What did she know about how he looked at obligations? And why was she right? My name, he sighed, defeated, is Crocus Younghand, and you're the daughter of the highborn Dahl, who all those suitors are lining up to be introduced to. But one day, you'll see me in that line, Shalice. And only you will know where you last saw me. It'll be a formal introduction, and I'll bring a gift, as is correct.
He stared at her, horrified by his own words. Her wide eyes held his, Emotion brightened them. Emotion he had no hope of understanding. Then she burst out laughing. She immediately clapped a hand over her mouth, then jolted forward on the bed.
"You'd better go, Crocus. Someone will have heard me. Quickly, and beware the tripwire."
Crocus moved woodenly to the balcony's sliding doors. Her laughter had been the final punctuation to all his dreams. He felt dead inside, except for a cynic's chuckle that might have been his own, given the odd look she threw him. Her blankets had fallen down around her, and once again she was naked. It astonished him in a distant way that she hadn't even seemed to notice. A voice came from beyond the door, leading to the hallway, indistinct. The girl hissed,
"Hurry, you fool!"
Alarm bells jangled in his head, awakening him. He had to move, and fast. Crocus stepped over the tripwire and opened the door. He paused to glance back at her, and smiled as she clutched the blankets to her neck. Well, at least he'd won that much. A knock sounded on the opposite door. Crocus emerged onto the balcony and hitched himself up onto the railing. He looked down into the garden and almost fell. The guard was gone. In his place stood a woman, and though she was cloaked, something about her triggered instant recognition. The woman from the bar. And she was looking right at him with dark eyes that burned him deep inside. The door in the room opened and Crocus shook himself.
"Damn that woman, anyway. Damn both of them."
He grasped the eaves above his head and swung lightly up and out of sight. Kalam crouched motionless in the middle of the rooftop, a knife in each hand. Around him was silence, the night air tense and heavy. Long minutes passed. At times he convinced himself he was alone, that Quick Ben and the other wizard had left the roof, that they hunted each other in the sky overhead, or in the alleys and streets below, or on another roof. But then he'd hear something, a drawn breath, a scuff of cloth against leather, or a wisp of wind would brush his cheek on this windless night. Then, before his eyes, the darkness was shattered. Two shapes appeared hovering over the rooftop. The assassin had found Quick Ben, attacking with a bolt of fire that seemed to stun the wizard, then swiftly closing the distance between himself and the dazed man. Kalam surged forward to intercept. Quick Ben vanished, then reappeared immediately behind the assassin. The blue flash of power bursting from the wizard's hands struck the magic-wielding assassin full in the back. Clothes aflame, the man tumbled through the air. Quick Ben whirled to Kalam.
"Come on, get moving!"
Kalam ran, his friend flying beside him. As they reached the roof's edge, he turned for a last look. The assassin mage had somehow snuffed the fire from his clothes and was regaining his balance. At the far edge, two of his comrades appeared.
"Jump!" Quick Ben said. "I'll stall them."
"With what?"
Kalam demanded, tottering on the edge. In answer, Quick Ben produced a small vial. He spun in the air and hurled it. Kalam cursed, then jumped. The vial struck the rooftop and shattered with a thin tinkle. Beyond, the three assassins paused. Quick Ben remained, his eyes on the white smoke rising from the glass shards. A figure took form within the smoke, growing in size. Its shape was almost insubstantial, the smoke stretching like threads in places, curling like wool in others. All that was visible within it was its eyes, two black slits, which it swung to Quick Ben.
"You,"
it said, its voice that of a child,
"are not Master Taishren."
"That's right," Quick Ben said, "but I'm in his legion. Your service remains with the Empire."
He pointed across the roof.
"There are three who are the Empire's enemies, demon, Tista Andy, here to oppose the Malazan Empire."
"My name is Pearl,"
the Korvala demon said softly, then turned to the three assassins who had spread out along the far edge.
"They are not fleeing,"
Pearl said, with a note of surprise. Quick Ben wiped sweat from his forehead. He glanced down. Kalam was a vague shape waiting in the alley below.
I know,
he said to Pearl. That observation had unnerved him as well. One of Teshren's Corvalari could level a city if it so chose.
They accept my challenge,
Pearl said, facing Quick Ben again.
Should I pity them?
No,
he answered.
Just kill them and be done with it.
Then I return to Master Teshren.
Yes.
What is your name, wizard?
He hesitated, then said,
Ben Adaphon Delat.
You are supposed to be dead,
Pearl said.
Your name is so marked on the scrolls of those high mages who fell to the Empire in Seven Cities.
Quick Ben glanced up.
Others are coming, Pearl. You're in for a fight.
The demon lifted its gaze. Above them, glowing figures descended, five in the first wave, one in the second. This last one radiated such power that Quick Ben shrank back, his blood chilled. The figure had something long and narrow strapped to its back.
Ben Adaphon Delat,
Pearl said plaintively.
See the last one who comes. You send me to my death.
I know,
Quick Ben whispered.
Flee, then. I will hold them enough to ensure your escape. No more.
Quick Ben sank down past the roof. Before he passed from sight, Pearl spoke again.
Ben Adaphon Delat, do you pity me?
Yes,
he replied softly, then pivoted and dropped down into darkness. Ralik walked down the center of the street. On either side of the wide corridor rose columns from which gas torches jutted, casting circles of blue light onto the wet cobblestones. The light rain had returned, coating everything in a slick sheen. To his right, and beyond the resident houses lining that side of the street, the pale domes of the High Thalanti on the hill glistened against the deep, grey sky. The temple was among the oldest structures in the city, its founding blocks over 2,000 years old. The Thalanti monks had come, like so many others, carried on the wings of the rumour. Ralik knew less about the story than did Murillo and Cole. One of the elder peoples was believed to have been entombed among the hills, an individual of great wealth and power. That was the extent of his knowledge. But it had been a rumour with many consequences. If not for the thousands of shafts sunk into the earth, the caverns of gas would never have been found. And while many of those shafts had collapsed or had been forgotten over the centuries, still others remained, now connected by tunnels. In one of the many chambers that honeycombed the ground beneath the temple, waited Vorkan, master of assassins. Ralik imagined Ocelot making his descent, burdened with the news of disaster, and it brought a smile to his lean face. He'd never met Vorkan, but Ocelot suited those catacombs, just another of the city's rats rushing about beneath his feet. One day, Ralik knew, he'd become a clan leader. He'd meet Vorkan face to face somewhere below. He wondered at how it would change him, and travelling down this path soured his thoughts with displeasure. He had no option. Once, he thought, as he approached the block of the Phoenix Inn long ago, there had been choices he could have made that would have sent him on a different path. But those days were dead, and the future held only nights, a stretch of darkness that led down to the eternal dark. He would meet Vorkan, eventually, and he'd swear his life to the Guildmaster. And that would be that, the closing of the final door. And his sense of outrage at the injustices around him, the corruptions of the world, would wither in the unlit tunnels beneath Darujistan. In the exactness of the methods of assassination, his final victim would be himself. And this, more than anything, made his and Murillo's scheme the last act of humanity he'd ever make. Betrayal was the greatest of all crimes in Ralik's mind, for it took all that was human within a person and made it a thing of pain. In the face of that, murder itself was surcease. It was quick, a and it ended the anguish and despair of a life without hope. If all went as planned, Lady Simtal and those men who had conspired with her in the betrayal of her husband, Lord Cole, would die. Could that right the wrong? Could it even the scales of retribution? No, but it might return to a man his life and his hope. For himself, Ralic, such gifts had long since been lost, and he was not the kind of man to stir the ashes. No embers survived, no flame could be born anew. Life belonged to other people, and his only claim to it was his power to take it from them. Nor would he recognize hope if it came to him. Too much a stranger, too long a ghost. As he neared the inn's entrance, Ralic saw Crocus approaching from down the street. He increased his pace.
"Crocus!" he called.
The boy flinched, then seeing Ralic, he stopped and waited. Ralic took his arm and steered him toward the alley without saying a word. Once in the shadows, he tightened his grip, swung Crocus round, and pulled him close.
"Listen to me," he hissed,
his face inches from the boy's own astonished visage.
"The guild's best was slaughtered tonight. This isn't a game. You stay off the rooftops. Do you understand me?"
Crocus nodded.
"And tell your uncle this. There's a claw in the city."
The boy's eyes widened.
"And," Ralic continued, "there's someone else. Someone coming down from the sky, killing everything in sight."
"Uncle Mahmud?"
"Just tell him. And now, listen carefully, Crocus. What I'm about to say is from me to you, one to one. Understand?"
Crocus nodded again, his face pale.
"You stay on this path, and you'll end up dead. I don't give a damn how exciting it all seems. What's excitement to you is desperation to others. Stop feeding off the city's lifeblood, lad. There's no hero's role in sucking others dry. Am I understood?"
"Yes,"
Crocus whispered. Ralic released the boy's arm and stepped back.
"Now, leave."
He shoved Crocus up the street, watching the boy stagger away and disappear around a corner. He drew a deep breath, surprised to find his hands trembling as he loosened his cloak's collar. Murillo stepped from the shadows.
"I'm not sure it'll work, friend, but it was a good try."
He laid a hand on the assassin's shoulder.
"Master Baruch has a job for us. Krupa insists we bring Crocus along."
Ralic frowned.
"Along? Are we leaving Darujistan, then?"
"Afraid so."
"Go without me," Ralic said. "Tell Baruch I can't be found. Everything's at a critical juncture, our planning included."
"Something else happening, Nom?"
"You heard the message I gave Crocus for his uncle?"
Murillo shook his head.
"I came late to your scene. Saw you dragging the lad into the alley."
"Well," Ralic said, "let's go inside. It's been a night to make Hood smile, friend."
Together, the two men strode from the alley. In the street outside the Phoenix Inn, dawn's light crept through the mists of the lingering rain. In the center of the rooftop lay a large patch of ash and bone that crackled faintly and cast out the occasional hissing spark. Anomanda Rake slammed his sword into its sheath.
"I sent 12 of you," he said to the black-caped figure standing beside him, "and I see but 8. What happened, Sarat?"
The Tista Andi woman was clearly exhausted.
"We've been working hard, Lord."
"Details?" Rake said abruptly.
Sarat sighed. "Jekaral has a broken neck and 3 cracked ribs. Boral's face is a mess. Broken nose, broken cheekbone, broken jaw."
"Who were they fighting?" Rake asked, turning to his lieutenant in exasperation.
"Has the guildmaster come out of hiding?"
"No, Lord. Both Jekaral and Borald fell to a single man, not of the city's guild."
Rake's eyes flashed dangerously.
"Claw?" "Possibly.
He was accompanied by a high mage, the one who gave us this Korvala to play with.
It had the smell of empire about it, Rake muttered, his gaze on the smouldering patch that had begun to eat its way into the roof. One of Taishrin's conjurings, I should think. A savage grin flashed. Pity to have disturbed his sleep this night.
Dashtal was struck by a poisoned quarrel, Sarat said. One of the guild's assassins managed that.
She hesitated.
Lord, we were hard-pressed in Brood's campaign. We're in need of rest. Mistakes were made this night. Some of the guild slipped through our fingers, and had you not answered my request, we would have suffered more casualties destroying this demon.
Rake placed his hands on his hips and surveyed the morning sky. After a moment he sighed. Ah, Sarat, don't think me insensitive, but the guild master must be flushed. This guild must be shut down. He eyed his lieutenant. This claw you encountered, do you think a meet was being established?
Not a meet, Sarat answered. A trap.
Rake nodded.
Good.
He paused, his eyes matching Sarat's with a shade of violet.
Return to Moonspawn, then. Have the High Priestess herself attend to Jakaral.
Sarat bowed.
Thank you, Lord.
She turned and gestured to the others.
Oh,
Rake said, raising his voice to address his cadre of assassin mages.
One last thing. You've done well, exceptionally well. You've earned a rest. 3 days and nights are yours to do with as you please.
Sarat bowed again.
We will mourn, Lord.
Mourn?
The poisoned quarrel killed Dashtal. The poison was the product of an alchemist, Lord. One of some ability. It contained Parolt.
I see.
Will you return with us?
No. The lieutenant bowed a third time. As one, the 8 Tista Andii raised their hands, then vanished. Rake glanced down at the sizzling patch, just as it ate through the roof and fell into darkness. There came a faint crash from below. Lord Anomander Rake swung his gaze back to the sky, then sighed. Sergeant Whiskey Jack rocked his chair onto its back 2 legs and anchored it against the crumbling wall. The small, dingy room reeked of urine and damp. 2 single beds, wood-framed with burlap mattresses stuffed with straw, ran along the wall to his left. The 3 other rickety chairs had been pulled up around the lone table in the room's center. Above the table hung an oil lantern, which shone down on Fiddler, Hedge, and Mallet as they sat playing cards. They'd done their work, finishing with the coming of dusk just outside Majesty Hall. Until the alliance with the Maranth, the Malazan Saboteur had been nothing more than a glorified sapper, a digger of tunnels and breaker of city gates. Maranth alchemy had introduced to the Empire a variety of chemical and powder explosives, most of which detonated when exposed to air. Applying a slow-working acid, wormholed the unfired clay shells. Sabotage had become an art. The precise equation of clay thickness and acid strength was tricky, and few survived to learn from their mistakes. To Whiskey Jack's mind, Hedge and Fiddler were terrible soldiers. He had trouble recalling the last time they'd unsheathed their short swords. Whatever discipline that had been part of their basic training had disintegrated through years in the field. Still, when it came to sabotage, they had no equals. Through hooded eyes, Whiskey Jack studied the 3 men sitting at the table. It had been some minutes since any of them had made a move or said a word. One of Fiddler's new games, he decided. The man was forever inventing new ones, improvising the rules whenever they gave him an edge. Despite the endless arguments, Fiddler was never short of players.
And that's what boredom can do, he said to himself.
But no. It was more than just boredom. Waiting gnawed, especially when it had to do with